Very warm good afternoon to all of you, my dear students, faculty members, of course Professor Samuel Weinberg, Diyadat, Vinita Tripathi from US India Educational Foundation in India, who are also co-sponsoring this particular important event, and my guests from other departments and centers. I think it's a great honor for us that we do have in our midst a very eminent scholar from Stanford University, California, US. His name is Professor Samuel Weinberg. He's currently a Fulbright Nehru Scholar at University of North Bengal at Siliguri. I just few minutes ago was telling him, last month incidentally, I was in that campus to give a lecture. And 2 years ago, I spent 10 days in the same campus. It is a lovely scenic campus, so we do have some things in common. Professor Samuel Weinberg is a Margaret Jacks Professor of Education and by courtesy a Professor of History at Stanford University in California, US. He holds a PhD in Psychological Studies in Education from Stanford and an honorary doctorate from Umeå University in Sweden. Dr. Weinberg's scholarship sits at the crossroads of three fields, history, cognitive science, and education. His work has appeared in such diverse outlets as Cognitive Science, Journal of American History, Smithsonian Magazine, and Los Angeles Times. His research has been featured in C-SPAN. I remember when I was in US, for many, many years, I was addicted to C-SPAN and CNN, and on NPR, National Public Radio, in the US, Canada, and Germany. Stories about his scholarship have appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, USA Today, and the New Yorker magazine. His 2002 book, Historical Thinking and Other Unnatural Acts, Charting the Future of Teaching the Past, published by Temple University, was awarded the Frederick W. Ness Prize from the Association of American Colleges and Universities for work that makes the most important contribution to the improvement of liberal education and understanding the liberal arts. In 2004, Professor Weinberg was named Fellow of the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences and a distinguished lecturer by the Organization of American Historians. In 2007, he was awarded the American Historical Association's William Gilbert Prize, and in both 2008 and 2011, the James Harvey Robinson Prize for the most important scholarship on the teaching of history. Today, we are going to listen from Professor Weinberg about qualitative research methods, which I think is extremely important, extremely germane to all our students. And I just was sharing with Professor Weinberg that at our postgraduate MA levels, each and every student have to take a mandatory course on research methodology. And also at a PhD level, we do have a full-fledged research methodology courses, where students are expected to learn all the basic aspects and nuances of research and how they can go from there. So we are extremely happy and delighted. Let me request our audience to give a big round of applause to Dr. Weinberg.
It is an honor to be here today. Thank you for coming. As you immediately can tell, I speak a very strange dialect of English. It is called American English. And I know from previous audiences that it can sometimes sound as if I'm speaking an entirely different language. So if you do not understand me, or if I start to speak too rapidly, may I ask you to give me this sign, to wave your hands at me and say, you need to speak much more slowly because we do not understand what you are trying to say. So will you agree with me that you will indicate with some gesture that I have started to speak so rapidly that no one can understand? Before I begin, let me tell you a little bit about myself and the kind of work that I do, because that is important context for the kinds of methodologies that I want to speak about and share with you. First of all, I will simply say that I am a social scientist, that while I recognize that there are variations in the methodologies from psychology, anthropology, and sociology, and economics, and I recognize that there are often worlds of difference between quantitative studies using large data sets and qualitative studies using very small samples, let me simply say to you that in my 27 years of being a professor, I have used them all. Now, there are some people who, when they choose a research methodology, it is like choosing a religious faith. They believe in it as if it is a statement from God, that they are a demographer, and they believe that the only way to find truth is to have a sample of 10,000. And then there are some people who are just as ideological about qualitative methods. They will say, they will turn the issue of quantitative into an issue of oppressing people, turning them into a number. How can I know you if I call you a 3 and you a 2? That demeans you, that disrespects your humanity. The only way that I can know you is through finding out your life story, and that cannot be reduced to a number. I recognize that people hold very strong beliefs about methodology. Let me say that I am not one of them. I begin with a very different assumption. I begin with the question of, what do I want to know about the social world? And so my question dictates the kinds of methods that I will think of as appropriate. In the past 5 years, I have completed a large-scale study where we try to understand how it is that American students, by naming the kinds of people that they think are important in history and giving them an opportunity to list them, how can we track changes in historical consciousness? In other words, if I were to give you a blank piece of paper and say, write down the 5 most important people in the history of India, and you're not checking them off, you are choosing who they are. You could choose your mother. You could say, my mother is the most important person, and she may be. But we did not at all regulate that. So we wanted to make a statement. We wanted to understand, how have changes in the curriculum and how have changes in the demographic shifts of the racial and ethnic composition of the United States, how has that influenced teenagers' perceptions? Now, the goal of that study was to try to come up with a portrait of the entire nation. So to interview one person and to say, what is your list? And to say, from this gentleman, I am going to talk about what's going on in the United States, is foolhardy. You would laugh at me. You would say, if you asked her, she would give you an answer different. So, no. In that study, we had an N, terminology that's familiar to you, an N. Let me know, there's some people nodding, and the people who are not nodding, it may not be familiar. So the alphabet, the letter N in an alphabet refers to a sample size. We had a sample in that study of 4,000 students. And so we had a very large data matrix. We used SPSS. We used many kinds of quantitative techniques in order to try to make a generalization to a portrait of an entire nation. Within the same 5-year period, I was interested in challenging notions of what is expertise in historical thinking. So even though I am an applied psychologist, my focus is what is the nature of historical thought? So if I were to give you some conflicting documents about an event in Indian history, from different sources, different perspectives, how do you form an interpretation in your mind? So you see how my work as a psychologist comes together with my interest in history. How do people make sense of the past? What historians do is they go into an archive and they study documents from the past. I do not go into an archive. I study historians. I study how they make sense. As a psychologist, what thought processes do they use? Within this same 5-year period, I published a paper with an N of 2. I compared 2 historians. So again, let me just simply say that all methodologies have value, and each methodology that you can choose is flawed. There is no perfect methodology in the social sciences. The social world is so complex that all we can try to do is to be cognizant, be aware of the flaws in our method, be open with our audience that these are flaws, and to recognize the limitations of our assertions. So that's a brief introduction to my own position about methodology. So, let me engage briefly in the notion of stocking the pantry. What does that mean? It means here are the variety of things that when we talk about qualitative methodologies, and let's just I'm going to make a few simplifications in order to try to bring some clarity. For our purposes, let's just simply distinguish between qualitative and quantitative by saying that quantitative is largely dealing in numbers and qualitative is largely dealing in words. Okay? So when we talk about qualitative work, these are the basic things that we're talking about. How do we observe in a social setting? What do we do to become a thoughtful and accurate observer so that the data that we collect when we watch something in a social setting is valid? We can then talk to people. How do we talk to people in a way that we actually elicit information from them rather than imposing our own judgments on them? The reason in qualitative research that we interview people is to find out about people we don't know. But when you watch inexperienced interviewers, you will often learn more about the interviewer than you will then from the person that they're interviewing. So how can we create a situation where you as an interviewer are truly gathering good data rather than simply imposing your judgments on the person that you're supposedly trying to find out about? Am I speaking too fast? Am I speaking okay? Okay, thank you. Tasks. Often we want to know something in particular about someone. And so we give them, in an interview situation, a problem to solve, a document to look at. I have many colleagues who study mathematical thinking. They will ask you to solve mathematical problems in front of them, but to talk about what you're thinking as you're solving them. That is another way of using qualitative methods to study what are effective and less effective ways of solving problems. Similarly with clinical interviews. A clinical interview is different than a regular interview. It means that whatever you do when you're solving that problem, the next question that I ask is dependent on the last thing that you did. So at the center of the interview are not the questions that I ask, but the task that I give you. Now, I purposely put this word down because for many people, when you say that you're going to talk about qualitative methodology, they say, we know what that is. It is ethnography. Can you just by a show of hands, if you have heard of ethnography, please raise your hand. For many people, when you say qualitative methods, they say, well, this is what anthropologists do. They go and they do field work. They go to a particular social setting. They learn the language. If they do not know the language, they stay there for a long time, months, sometimes years, sometimes spending years going back to the same setting. Famous anthropologists, Claude Levi-Strauss, Clifford Geertz, Richard Schwader, go to settings that they don't know, they learn the language, and they immerse themselves in the culture. And for many people, when you say, I do qualitative research, they say, that's what it is.
Oops.
I am not going to talk about ethnography today. If you have the desire to do ethnography, you can email me and I can give you some good references. But it is the one form of research that I have never done. The kind of research that I do is always a mixture of different methodologies, and it is usually of a shorter term duration. I have never had the opportunity to go and to situate myself in a research setting for 18 months and do ethnography. So I want to just simply say that what I'm going to be talking about today are shorter, more focused methods. And then here are some of the other things that are talked about under qualitative methods. Discourse analysis, which is the focused analysis of speech and how ideas are transacted in speech. Conversation analysis, which is very similar, and the collection of unobtrusive measures, where you observe what is going on after people leave a room. What do they leave behind? What notes do you find on the floor? How do you study a situation where you are not being involved and you're not interviewing and you're not observing because you do not want to affect the social setting that you see? So that is, in general, that is, if you will, think of going to a restaurant and seeing a menu. This is the menu, but today we don't have this. This is not on the menu. So what is our focus today? I would like to talk a little bit. I will begin by talking about how we observe. I want to then talk about what are some good guidelines when you are doing interviews in a qualitative fashion. And then finally, because so much of my own work as a researcher is built around tasks, I want to give you a taste of what that feels like. What does a qualitative research strategy look like where tasks are at the center? Okay? All right. So, I would like to begin with the notion of observing. How do we observe? How do we understand what is going on in a social setting by opening our eyes and watching and listening about what is going on? Let me first say that there are a set of guidelines for being and developing skills as an observer where you are increasing your natural tendency to see things in a social setting. And to do that, I have a handout that I am going to give you. Hold on one second. Let me locate it. Oh, no. Did I bring my hat? Yes. This is my computer. No, it's... No. I had it this morning. This is not a lecture.
So, these are the instructions for you. Now, can you read this? Describe as carefully as possible the professor's tie, and reconstruct as accurately what he said. So, probably he'll come in.
Please jot down on your paper. Describe as carefully as possible my tie and reconstruct as accurately as possible the actual words I said prior to leaving the room. Okay, now you need to help me. I can't do this by myself. Who? Please, let's begin with a... this is the easy part. Describe my tie. We were all... Let's describe it in terms of its color, its texture, what it had on it, etc. So let's begin. Who would like to begin? Please. You're sitting very close. Let me first ask you a question. Are you colorblind? So you are not colorblind. So let's do an empirical test. What is the color of the top of this water bottle?
It's green.
Good enough. Okay, so what was my tie like?
Actually, it was a little bit thick. It was not thin. And it was a pinstripe design of dark blue color.
A pinstripe design?
Of dark blue color.
Of dark blue. Stripes?
Yeah.
Straight down or horizontal? Or
horizontal.
Diagonal?
Yeah.
Diagonal stripes. Do we, if you agree with this excellent suggestion, please raise your hand. Aha! Are there people who saw something different? Sir, what did you see?
There was some correlated kind of shapes. No, they were not exactly correlated, but kind of, they had four edges, and one of them was in the center, you know, actually at the navel button or stuff.
There were shapes.
Yeah, there were shapes.
And there was one in the center. right at my navel, like that. Round, rectangle, what was the shape?
Rectangle, but it was not exactly a rectangle, it was kind of...
A rectangle. What color was my tie?
Blue.
The tie was blue. You are very close. It was blue and red. Sir.
It was thick, blue background, crisscross pattern and diamond shapes with reddish tender.
It was crisscrossed, diamond shapes. What was crisscrossed?
The pattern was like crisscrossed, but the shapes in between, they were diamond.
They were crisscrossed stripes.
In the diamond pattern.
See, with the same blue color, it was colliding with the color, because the same color was used for those crisscross stripes, and then there were red color.
Crisscross stripes that were red in a floating pattern that had a design at the center of my navel. Is there anyone who saw something very different and thinks that all of these people have taken some very strange chemical this morning? Sir?
Please, sir, I saw it. Maybe I'm just colorblind, or I saw it. It was dark red.
Dark red?
Yeah, not blue.
Sir, why are you wearing spectacles?
Negative eyesight.
Uh-huh. But that does not affect your ability to see distance.
Yeah.
It does.
A little bit, because I could not differentiate the stripes or the checks or whatever there was. I could just see the tie. It was really a little bit thin over here. It was a double stripe type of tie. I'm not really expert of tie, but it was really thin.
Uh-huh. That was a little bit tight here.
Yeah. I saw you, sir. It was like, oh, sir, it's really very organized and maintained type of tie.
Professor, please give a negative mark to that. Since we are all in agreement about what exactly my tie looked like, let's move on to the next question. What did I say before I left the room? This is not a lecture. What did I say before that? One at a time. Please, in the back.
Right.
I am sure I had it this morning.
That's what I asked.
Who heard something different?
Where's my bag?
which came first? I said, where is my bag?
Yes.
Is the word bag the word I used?
Bag. Hand out. The pack. Where's my pack?
Hand out?
You said, where's my pack?
Bag.
Pack.
I used the word pack.
Bag.
Where is my pack?
Yeah.
And you said, where is my bag?
Yeah.
Did I use the word pack or bag?
Bag.
Bag.
How many people say bag? How many people say pack?
Bag.
How many people are certain that I was wearing a tie? And what if I were to say to you, this is the tie that you have described as stripes, pinstripes, red. Where is something? Is this the one that was at the center of my name? Now, what does this demonstrate? This demonstrates that without a particular frame, when you are observing, you will attend to anything. Your mind will go in every kind of direction. You might have been looking and say, ah, I hope that when I get to his age, I have more hair on the top of my head than he does. You might have said, ah, how dapper. Look at how his belt matches his shirt. And you might not have attended to my tie. And so one of the first things that we have to think about when we observe is, what is our frame? Because we cannot observe everything. Unless we want to go into the field with a video camera and record everything, which for those of you who want to do social research, you know how difficult that is. Because when we take images of people, we have to obtain their consent. And it's very, very complicated. So when we observe, we are often taking what are known as field notes. And without a frame for social research, we have nothing to focus our attention. And consequently, because you were not focused, many of you came up with very bizarre ideas of what this is. Now, let me give you another exercise and try to focus your attention and see if you do any better. This is an opportunity for you to redeem yourselves. So let's see. How's the sound here?
Use the volume, sir.
Use the volume on the bottom. Let's go up. In the media player as well. Okay, so let's go back to the beginning. All right, what I'm going to ask you to do is you are going to see people throwing a basketball. And your job is to, as accurately as possible, this is a mixture of both observing and counting, so this is a mixed method exercise of qualitative and quantitative. Count how many times the players in white pass the basketball. You will see a group of people throwing a ball. Focus on the players wearing white and count as accurately as possible how many times they pass the basketball. And then don't say anything to anyone near you, but write down the number on your paper. So I'm giving you a very specific frame, unlike before where you could have observed anything about me. In this instance, we are going to do an exercise where you are going to watch something and watch it carefully. Are we ready?
Yes.
Yes. Please do not speak. Please just focus on your number. How many people counted 15 times? What is wrong with this side of the room? This side of the room has a preponderance of accurate counters because the correct number is 15 times. So please, those of you who have succeeded on this test, be proud of your hand. Please keep it up. Let your colleagues know your accuracy. Now, let me ask you, those of you who got it, what did you see as you were watching this tape?
A gorilla game.
What did you see? Okay, so what did you see, sir?
Sir, I was focusing on...
Yes, so what did you see?
Every time they passed the ball, I put a line and then
yes.
I counted, I was 15.
You counted 15.
Yes.
As you were watching this tape, did you see anything unusual?
Yes, sir.
What did you see?
There were some people in fur kind of clothing, attire. They came in between.
Uh-huh.
Towards the later part of the...
The other people who had 15, keep your hands up. May I ask you, what did you see? You in the back, please. Yes. Yes?
They around and missing the blacks.
Okay.
And they catch the ball.
And anything unusual?
There was a monster disturbing the
blacks. What? did every This, who said monster? You said that, monster? Excuse me, sir, you have the floor. What did you see? You see monsters? What kind of monster? No, please give this gentleman the floor. Describe monsters. This is about basketballs and passing a basketball.
Yeah, right. The white guy passing the ball, but in black, there was a devil creature who was disturbing them.
Are there psychological services on campus? If you want to agree with this unusual statement, please raise your hand. If you don't know, have any idea what this gentleman is talking about, please raise your hand. You have no idea what this man is talking about because you were focused on this. Now let me go back to the beginning. And I want... So excuse me, you think it's a monster? What is it? We must respect you. Would you describe the tie that the monster was wearing? What was this monster? What did the monster look like? A suggestion? Okay, in order to ascertain whether this gentleman is in need of special health services, we will watch this tape again, but this time, do not count the number of, don't focus on the basketball, focus on what is going on and see if you see anything unusual. Okay? Are you ready? Not the number of times it's you count, but let's go back to the start. Watch very carefully, and we'll see if we too see anything unusual. So what does this show us? This shows us the opposite of what happened with our tie. You can be so focused on a specific instance when you go into the field that if a monster wearing a gorilla suit walks in between what you're seeing, you won't even see it because that's not part of your research. So again, these are the two poles. The one pole of if there is no frame, then your accuracy is dispersed across all kinds of different things. On the other hand, if you are so focused, then when there is truly a significant event, you may miss it because you have tunnel vision in your observation. So when we think about observing in a social setting, we have to think about a frame that is focused on our research question of interest, but not so narrow that if something truly even more significant happens, we will miss it because we had what's called tunnel vision, only focused on one thing. So how do we do that? Because when we do social research, we are often reliant upon our pen and our paper. Even today, even when all of you, many of you have laptops or you have smartphones, when you go into the field, in order not to stick out, in order to blend in, it's still, even in a digital age, it is still much more conventional to actually be taking handwritten notes. Most of my work is in educational settings, in classrooms at the secondary level. And I have students, graduate students who are your age, and they say, Professor Weinberg, it is not comfortable for us to write in a notebook. We are much more comfortable with a keyboard. And so maybe old people like you need to do this, but I prefer to type. When you are typing in a social setting, what students will often do when they are watching is they will come in and they will say, let me see what you're right. Your typing often will be a distraction. And so you can come up with all kinds of conventions when you are writing that make you stick out less. That is my advice to you. Now, you may say to me, I disagree with you. I've been in settings where I've actually used my laptop and it's not been a problem, and that's okay. I'm just giving you some advice from my own experience. So, let's talk about, you are in a social setting. You want to understand a new social policy that is just going into effect, and you are in a government office, and you are watching people come in to try to obtain services from the clerks in that government office, and you're trying to understand what is the nature of implementation and how are the government employees treating the people who are coming in for services. Okay, so I'm just making up a particular scenario for you. When you are in that setting and you write things down and you go home, those are your data. That's all you have. If your mind wanders or you think, this is very important, but I'm just going to write down one word, you may go home and look at what you've written and say, what was I thinking? What does this mean? Memory. There are so many details in a social setting that it is very, very hard to reconstruct those details even an hour later. Now, what are some guidelines for observing? Try to be as specific as possible. Try to focus on the concrete rather than the abstract. The gentleman was wearing a tie. What kind of tie? The gentleman was wearing a maroon, teal-like tie with rather rectangular size shapes that had a part in the middle where the background of the tie actually showed through. Okay? We can argue with my description, but it's better than saying he had on a tie. He had on a tie that forced his top button to be closed, and I'm not sure, but he might have looked uncomfortable because of it. One of the most common things, and again, I am bringing to you examples from my own research, not because they are the perfect way to do it. It is simply the way that I was taught to do it. And over the years, I've seen many, many people use field notes in this kind of way. There are many variations. This is my particular way. It is very, very common to have what's known as a timestamp. On the extreme left-hand side of the page, when you go into a setting, in order to keep yourself honest, in order so that your mind does not wander, you are always trying to record the number of minutes, every 2 or 3 minutes, and you keep it along the side. This is from 1985. It tells you how old I am as a researcher. And I went from 8:57 to 9:10. A duration of 13 minutes without a timestamp. This is not good. When I look at this now, I would say, no. Now when I observe every 2 or 3 minutes, I am writing down the time and trying to write down what goes on. The next thing that you'll often see is that field researchers will try to create a differentiation between what is actually happening in a setting versus what is their interpretation of it. Now, we are always making judgments. You judged me the minute I walked in. You looked at me. You listened to me. When I started to fumble around with my pages, you might have thought, he's disorganized. That's not very professional for a university professor. You might have come up with all... It is impossible to stop making judgments. I defy you at this moment to not judge what's going on in the room. The human brain is constructed to quickly size up situations and classify them and categorize them. What is the problem of that when you are a social researcher? It goes back to something that I said right at the start. Are you more interested in the in understanding the phenomenon that you want to study, or is your goal to inflict all of your judgments onto that setting? Inexperienced researchers, when you look at their field notes when they are inexperienced, will often tell you much more about the judgments of the researcher than the topic of the research. Very, very common. And it's common to all of us as a species. So what do we do to try to modify it? This is one basic and very imperfect method to try to accurately write down what was said. And if we have a thought, it seems like he was angry. It seems, notice the words I'm using, it seems like he was flustered. It seems like he was not prepared. Those seems, which you are not sure of, you do not know if I was truly angry or in this particular instance the whole thing was a performance. Those go into observer comments, interpretations. Now, let me give you an example. Here's some examples of field notes. Here is from a colleague of mine, Professor Michael Knapp, an educational policy researcher at the University of Washington. He has timestamps. He doesn't use a form, but you'll also notice when he takes field notes, he writes little diagrams. He draws little pictures. If you undertake this work, if you choose to do this kind of social research where you're going into the field, you are actually the instrument of research. Now, what is it? Well, that's a very strange comment. Let me compare it to a quantitative researcher. If I am doing an experimental design and I am doing an analysis of variance, I am using a statistical procedure and I consult a computer program. And if I am using, my goodness, a personality measure, the Myers-Briggs personality inventory, the instrument of research is that survey that I give to the participant. And then I analyze my data using a computer program. When I go into the field to do observations, I am the instrument. I am the I cannot separate myself from what I am observing. And so you have to be very attentive to who you are. What works for you? For this gentleman, making little pictures works for him. Should you do that? It depends. Does it work for you? There is no recipe for perfection here. This is something where you go into the field and by trial and error, you figure out, how do I take field notes in a way that will truly help me so that when I have to come back and analyze them and conceptualize what I learned, I will be able to reconstruct as much as I can of what I saw in that government office. Here is another example. This is from a PhD student that I had, who before she came to do her PhD, she was a professional journalist. And for years as a journalist, she was always taking notes when people spoke. And I saw the nature of her notes, which were so detailed with pictures. And here's what she had a convention that immediately when she left the setting, while things were fresh in her mind, she wrote her interpretations or her additions in a different colored pen. But she had developed such an elaborate system that I told her, no matter what I say in our seminar, do not change what you do. You have already learned how to be the instrument of research for yourself. You've got it down. Don't change it. Don't fix something that isn't broken. So again, there is a quality of idiosyncraticness with it. You have to know yourself to develop what is the system for you that works. Okay. Let's take this as an example. This is a field note. Someone goes into a setting and there is a new client and there is an interview that they have to go through, and the researcher writes down in her field notes, the new client was uneasy waiting for her intake interview. Please think about that for a second. Let me tell you that this is a piece of, this is an observation that is a problem. What is the problem with this field note? Please.
The person has become too assertive. She has stated that the client was uneasy. She is not, it is not an interpretation as such, but she has become very assertive that the interviewer was uneasy.
Sir,
it lacks a description of the client from which you can infer that he was uneasy. So there's no description which would tell the reader why he thought he was uneasy.
Other thoughts about what's a problem here? Let me ask you, what is uneasy? What does uneasy look like?
Uncomfortable.
What does uncomfortable look like? Do you see someone who is uneasy or uncomfortable? Is that what you see? Or is that already a judgment that is one level higher than what the person is actually doing?
Actually, this uneasiness, these are all our definitions. It means each person has its own definitions of uneasiness.
So I could be sitting here like this and going like this with my leg, and you would say, he is uneasy, and perhaps I just need to go to the toilet. So it's a judgment. What you could describe is, the gentleman's knee is going up and down, and he is tapping his foot, which is a behavior that could be interpreted in several different ways, correct? But notice how if you immediately say, he was uneasily tapping his leg, how that is already a mixture of what I was doing with your judgment. So this is a problematic way. This is not the way you should try to capture what goes on in a social setting. Now what I'm going to show you is an alternative. It's not perfect. There are still judgments in it. But when we are talking about research in the social world, we are talking about how to make something better, not perfect. How do we improve something? Because there's never any perfection in social research. So let me show you something that, in my opinion, is better than this. And you can tell me whether you agree or disagree. Let's close this. At first, the new client sat very stiffly in the chair next to the receptionist's desk. She picked up a magazine and let the pages flutter through her fingers very quickly without really looking at any of the pages. She set the magazine down, looked at her watch, pulled her skirt down, and picked up the magazine again. This time she did not look at the magazine. She set it back down, took out a cigarette, and began smoking. She would watch the receptionist out of the corner of her eye and then look down at the magazine and then back up at the two or three people waiting in the room. Her eyes moved from the people to the magazine and back to the people. When her name was finally called, she jumped as if she was startled. Better or worse? Why is it better? What does it do that's better? There's descriptions. Is it specific?
Yes. Actions. It is not judging. It is telling the actions that happened in the...
There's actions with... Do we all agree with this woman's perception that there is no judgment here? Is there any instance of judgment here? I would claim there is. She was startled. So the notion of being startled is itself a judgment. Again, that just proves my point. This is not the difference between imperfection and perfection. This is better. This gives you more information that needs to be verified. This is what you should aspire to when you're writing, to try to modify your own judgment and actually record the behaviors that would allow you to characterize the judgment. Let me give you another example. The next student who came into the test, the next student who came in to take the test, was very poorly dressed. What's the problem?
It's the same thing. It lacks a description of the person who's poorly dressed. What defines poorly dressed?
What defines poorly dressed? Your judgment of what's well-dressed and what's poorly dressed could differ from the woman who's sitting next to you. You could say this person was poorly dressed, and the woman sitting next to you could say, actually, I think that she's quite well-dressed and well-groomed, without a description. This, if this is your only thing as a field note, again, it would say much more about you than it would about what you observed, which is a deep statement and the deepest moral and ethical statement and question a researcher can ask him or herself. Are you doing social research to impose your views on the world or to allow the complexity of the world to expand your own horizons? So let's look at a more fully description of this and see if it's better. The next student who came into the room was wearing clothes quite different from the three students who'd been in previously. Let's stop there. Is that an appropriate statement to make? May I ask you to articulate why you think it's appropriate, that it's not objectionable?
She's not being judgmental. She's simply saying they were dressed differently from the other people who earlier were dressed. That is not judging.
She dresses differently than...
Please speak up, I can't hear you.
Yeah, here also, person is wearing quite differently, but everybody wears differently.
Okay, so what we have is, we're trying to understand a social setting, and the person writing this note is making a comparative judgment, which we want to see more of, but I would say it is within the bounds of appropriateness, if we know more about the setting. The three previous students looked like they had been groomed before they came to the test. The word groomed, is that, do we all agree what it means to be groomed? Do we all agree? Raise your hand if you think that there might be disagreements in this room about describing someone who is groomed. Yes, there are disagreements. So, let's see if the description goes on. Their hair was combed and their clothes were clean and pressed. The new student had on pants that were soiled with a hole or rip in one knee and a denim patch in the seat. His striped shirt was wrinkled with one tail tucked into the pants and the other tail hanging out. What is that? Do you see an image in your mind? What does that look like? This gentleman is demonstrating it here. One tail is in and one tail is out. What does that often indicate to us?
Shabby.
That rushed, shabby. Maybe someone did not look in the mirror. Maybe someone was hurried. We can make many inferences about what it means, but we're on the level of description here. One tail is in and the other is out. His hair was disheveled. Again, you might say the professor's hair is disheveled. Or the very little hair that the professor still has left is disheveled. And his hands looked like he had been playing in the engine of a car. What does that mean? His hands looked like he had been playing in the engine of a car. How would we improve that? How would we improve that description? What could we say without making the leap to judgment that he was working as a mechanic? What could we say? His hands were covered with a black substance that seemed to have been grease. Okay? So even here, even though this is better, we can still find ways to improve it. Okay. So, let me sum up the issue of observation with this. Each one of us has a God-given ability to quickly categorize and make judgments about the world. We have been doing it since birth. It is what allows us to survive. It is what allows us to function smoothly in social settings. You are all experts at it. The fact that you are sitting in a university means that you are the successes of the educational system. You are indicating by virtue of your presence here a particular quality of quickness, of judgment, of the ability to understand a new situation. Those very qualities which have allowed you to get here can in many ways interfere with your sensitivity as a social researcher. And so we must bring some safeguards into our own way of capturing social settings that allow us to both understand what goes on in a social situation, what actually is going on, without trying to pretend that we can't make judgments, but to try to, as accurately as possible, with less judgment, not saying no judgment, it is impossible not to judge. These things, there's judgment all through here, but there is less judgment than this. And so we can always get better than our natural tendency. When you take field notes in a social setting, you must always remember that those are your data. And if your data are incomplete and sloppy and your mind wanders, then that is what you will have to work with as a researcher. And the final thing I will say about observations is, how do you get better at this? You could read books. I will give you a reading list with some recommendations. But it is no different than saying, if you want to become a better swimmer, let me give you an article about doing the crawl stroke. And if you want to become an even better swimmer, I will give you an article about doing the breaststroke. And if you still want to become a better swimmer, I will give you an article about doing the side stroke. If you want to swim better, then get wet. Go into a pool. If you want to get better as a social researcher, A, be gentle with yourself because you will make mistakes. This is not easy. This way of observing does not come naturally to me. I know this because I compare myself to other people who do this work, and I am not a natural at it. But I have improved dramatically over 30 years of doing this work by doing it and making mistakes. Let me pause for a second, see if there's any questions. I'll take a few questions. Do we have a break?
Yes, we have a break.
Okay. and then we'll come back and we'll talk about interviewing. But let me just see one or two questions before we take a break. If there are not questions, we'll take a break and come back. But let me just see if there's any burning questions.
Miss. The previous example.
The previous one.
So when you said that either somebody suggested or you said that there's a problem when we say that she was startled. As a researcher, can we not even assume that somebody is startled? Is that being too assumptuous, or as in, we can't even assume somebody is startled?
The word that I would add here, and again, this makes a slight improvement, and we can argue about whether we even think it's an improvement. I would add, I like the notion, as if she was startled is good, or she seemed to be startled. The seemed indicates that there is room for error in our judgment. Okay. All right, let's take a brief, how long? I don't know what's appropriate.
We'll come back after 15 minutes.
15 minutes? Okay.
Please don't go up far away, come back.
Okay, part two. And you are going to have to help me in this part because I cannot do it if there are not some volunteers. So I'm going to ask for volunteers. For those who need courage, who've never volunteered, I would like you to think about this will be your opportunity to display courage and do something that you've never done before. So I'm not going to ask yet, but I want you to think about volunteering. Okay. So there are a variety of ways. We're moving from observing people to asking them questions in an interview. There are three general categories of interviewing. The first is structured interviews. A structured interview is often what happens when a census worker comes to you and says, here are the questions that I must ask you. So for example, it's very similar to a survey. So in a survey, you might be asked a question, how religious are you? Very devout? Devout? Somewhat devout, lax, or very lax. Now, if I ask that question of you, I must ask in a structured interview exactly the same question to you. But if you say devout, and you say devout, I have to assume that you are meaning this very same thing. And so you will rarely see structured interviewing in qualitative research. It is much more common of a survey where you can then indicate, if a person says very devout, that gets a 5, devout gets a 4, somewhat devout gets a 3, lax gets a 2, and very lax gets a 1. And that's good for quantitative analysis. But recognize the assumption there. The assumption is that words mean the same thing to everyone who responds. That is the assumption that you have to mean, and if you have to take, and I would imagine that you would agree with me, that we could come up with words like that, and we would disagree terribly about what those words mean. The more common way of interviewing in qualitative research is what's known as semi-structured. It means that when I am thinking about the topic that I want to interview about you about, I come up with some general questions. But the most important thing for me to find out is whether you understand me when I ask it. If I ask you a question and there's a kind of barrier with your understanding, I can see it on your face, then I must be able to change the wording of that question so that you understand what I want to find out about. This is known as fixing questions in meaning and not in words. you are less concerned about the precise word that you use when you interview than making sure that the person understands the meaning behind the question. There's a very famous paper by a researcher named Elliot Mishler, M-I-S-C-H-L-E-R, called Meaning in Context, Is There Any Other Kind? And he was the one who gave form to this notion that questions are fixed in meaning in a semi-structured interview. And you have flexibility and a certain kind of ability to bend questions to make sure that the person you're interviewing understands what you want. And then there are narrative life history interviews, probably the most in-depth kind of interviewing you can do, where you are trying to understand someone's entire life story. And these interviews can go on over a series of days and maybe all told be 25, 30 hours of interviews just with one person. I have never done narrative life history interviews, and so therefore am not qualified to talk about them, but I can give you a reference for doing it. It is very, very commonly used in research paradigms that come from a feminist perspective. And that there's reasons we could talk about that. There's the underlying notion that the only way that you can understand someone is through the establishment of a deeply intimate relationship, and that develops over time. A lot of hours. So I'm going to restrict what I say to essentially to semi-structured interviews. Now, what do you do? How do you prepare for an interview? Well, it depends on what you want to find out about. And so, the first thing that you do is something, of course, that you can already predict. You have read the literature. You are familiar with the kinds of research papers that have already been done about your topic. The reason that you are doing research is to find out something that isn't known, correct? That's why we do research. If it's already known, then go do something more useful. Read a book. Watch a movie. But we do research when we don't know something. So you identified a gap, but you are not ignorant, because often the literature tells you things that are appropriate, that circle around your topic, maybe not your exact question, but they give you ideas about the kinds of things that you want to find out in an interview. So what you do when you get ready for a semi-structured interview is you develop what's known as an interview protocol, which is a document that you use when you go into an interview in order to guide the kinds of questions you will ask. What is the right way to produce an interview protocol? There is no right way. There are bad things you can do, and 99% of the bad things that you can do can be summarized by saying being unprepared. You haven't adequately thought about what you really want to find out. So you are wasting the person's time who has agreed to be interviewed, and you are ultimately wasting your own time as a researcher. But there are many, many different ways of preparing an interview protocol. Today, because of the shortness of time, I'm only going to give you three examples. And they are in the handout. So if you look at page 2, it looks like it says categories of reasons for student success and failure. This one right here. This is from a qualitative interview. Everybody see where I am? It says at the top. And it says at the bottom, from P. Phelan. This is actually, again, none of this is cooked up. This is actually, you might say, professor, I see problems in this. Of course. This is touched by human hands. This is not feigned. This is not artificial. This is borrowed from a colleague of mine from an actual study that she did to try to understand why students succeed or fail in school. Now, if I say to you an interview protocol should have questions, what is the first thing you notice about this? Are there questions here?
No.
There are no questions here. What is organized here is this is an interview protocol that is organized about by topics. The interviewer knows that there are clusters of things that she wants to ask about. And rather than putting down, I'm going to say, tell me about parent support, no. There are just general categories, but see, they are organized into these categories, which means that if I am asking you, tell me, I'd like to know you are successful in school. Please tell me about your parents and what role your parents played in your schooling. Now, if you started to respond to me and say, ah, my mother was a teacher, and it was very important for her to send me to a school where the teachers were very, very good. And so she sent me to this particular school, even though it meant that I had to go on a bus for a half hour. But at this school, I met this teacher of mathematics, and she pushed me and said, I will not allow you to see yourself as unable to do mathematics. And your interviewee starts to talk about schooling, even though you asked about support from parents, then you can, as you are being an interviewer, you are already going down. You know your interview protocol very well. You studied it. And you put a little check mark there in order to try to create the natural flow of a conversation. Rather than saying, I'm going to ask you this, and this, and this, and this, which we all know is the most artificial way of a human interaction. It doesn't feel right. The best interview is when people start to talk almost conversationally. And so this is one example of that kind of interview protocol. Turn the page. So this was from a study that I did with my colleagues that was really coming from what is known as a phenomenological approach. That's a big fancy piece of jargon that basically means you are trying to understand someone's experience from inside of their experience. What does the experience look like to them? So this was in a high secondary school history class where students were told that they had to fill out certain assignments and essays, and the teacher had certain goals with those, but we wanted to understand, what does the student think that they're really supposed to do? When a teacher gives a particular mark on an essay, how does the student interpret it? So you'll see, it begins with a very general question. Describe for me a typical day in history class. Walk me through what's happening in the class from the moment it starts till the moment it stops. And the student will begin to speak, and your role as an interviewer is to say, if a student says something that where the student is not fully explaining herself, you could say, can you tell me more about that? Or can you give me an example of that? And so there are follow-up questions that you can ask, but here's the general open-ended question that is not saying, tell me about your life as a 14-year-old, or tell me about what it's like to be a student in this school. Your research question is focused on how is history experienced in this school by the student. Look at question number three. Students collected their written work over a year in what is known as a portfolio, simply a folio or a folder where all of their assignments are kept. And we asked students to essentially explain to us how they interpret what's in that folder. So show it to me. What's in it? Walk me through and explain what you're trying to do with each assignment. So again, the teacher gives the assignment, and it is often assumed that students really understand what they're supposed to do, but often what they're doing is playing the game of school and going through the motions. So this was an attempt to understand, what does school look like from the mind and eyes of a 14-year-old? Turn the page. This is from my colleague. Again, these are real examples. This is from a colleague of mine. Her name is Pamela Grossman. And she tries to understand how do teachers conceptualize what good teaching looks like? And here is focused on English teaching. So look at the nature of questions that she asks.
It's the next page.
It's the, yes, it looks, it's up there. It says, note-taking template, researcher synthesis of interviews. Now, what is the goal with the variety of these interview protocols? The goal is to try to create a situation. Often, when you don't know someone, in much of the work that I do in trying to understand, for instance, government educational policy in different regions, I make an appointment with an official. That official says, you can have 60 minutes of my time, not a minute more. I get in my automobile, I travel for 4 hours. If I am late, then I've lost my opportunity, I've wasted my resources, I've wasted at this stage of my life the money of the organization that often provided the funds to do the research, and then I've embarrassed myself by not being professional in the way that I conduct myself. But say that I am there on time, I have 1 hour of a very busy person's time, and I need to use that hour as efficiently and as best as I possibly can. How not to waste my time, his time, and the money that was given to us to do the work? The goal is to very quickly establish rapport, introduce yourself, try to be sufficiently friendly, and then allow the person to teach you about what you are there to find out. To find out a way of asking questions that give a person an opportunity to express themselves rather than you putting words into their mouth. Okay. So even though there are variations here, that is the common theme that unites them. Now, please turn over the page. You'll see a series of questions. It's on the page that begins, to measure job satisfaction. Please, everybody with me on that page? Please circle one with your pen. Circle question one. Question two. Question four. And question seven, but there's a typo on question seven. Please correct it. To assess how teachers gauge the progress. Please spend a moment. Each one of these questions is a problem. Each one of these questions is, if you will permit me to say, a bad interview question for qualitative research. Please spend a moment and try to see if you can make them, see if you can identify the problem with the question, and how might you make it better if you were truly interested in finding out what is at the heart of each one of these questions. Okay, let's do this together. If you are interested in understanding people's job satisfaction, their satisfaction with their employment, the job that they have, you ask a question: how satisfied would you say you are with your present position? Very, somewhat, not so much, not at all. What's wrong? Why isn't it? I like it. It's a nice question. What's wrong with it? It's clear. What's the problem? Miss, please.
It doesn't give the interviewee a chance to express why he or she is satisfied or not. The reasons of satisfaction or dissatisfaction, he or she will not be able to express that because it is a structured question.
How about if I were to add underneath it, whatever the respondent says, ask why? Would that improve it?
Yes.
Yes. No. Let's hear someone who wants to articulate a reason. Yes. I heard many yeses, so please let's have an articulation.
But that was not the purpose of the question, to find out the reason. The purpose of this question was to find whether they are satisfied or not. The interviewer does not seem to be concerned about the reason yet, in the first place.
If we truly want to know how people feel about their job, and we want to give them the power to express themselves, how do we do this? How might we do this in a way that's different from what how it's phrased here? How might we begin?
What do you mean by job satisfaction?
One at a time. So you are interviewing me, you have an hour with me. Go ahead, please, loud.
Okay, so what do you mean by job satisfaction?
Job satisfaction, to me, job satisfaction is comprised of three components. Clearly, salary is a huge aspect when we think of the broad category of job satisfaction. On the other hand, the other component of job satisfaction might be how much time a person has to spend commuting. That is also very important. What have I done? Have you learned about my job satisfaction? You've given me an opportunity perhaps to philosophize about the broad concept of job satisfaction. But if you are interested in how I feel about my job, how would you simply begin an interview?
Are you satisfied with your job?
Yes.
There is nothing to explain
why you say that.
Was there a problem with my response of yes? Do you feel that I owe you an explanation? Piece of advice, and I say this with love in my heart and not as criticism. Try at all costs, when you are getting someone to talk, try not to ask a yes or no question. Yes or no questions are one-way streets. So if we want to know about how I feel about my job, what is an open-ended way that you can ask me? What? Give me some examples, please.
So first of all, I think this question is too direct and it pushes the person into a corner.
Wonderful. So I interview me and start and do it better.
Sir, I think I would begin.
No, not sir.
Okay.
Interview me, yes. You've got an hour with me and I'm busy. And you're wasting my time already.
I would say how long...
No, not how you say. I'm here. Do it.
How long have you been on this job?
14 years.
And what do you think are your future vision?
Get the hell out of here.
This speaks. You have responded and this might be missing.
Okay. You're asking me about the future, how much longer, but I want you to think about... How would you ask me to elicit my own thoughts? What's just a very simple way of beginning that is non-judgmental?
Tell me about your job!
Tell me about your job! This is not, as we say in American English, this is not rocket science. Tell me about your job. Give someone a very broad opening. I am not interested in the sports that you play. I am not interested in the automobile that you want to buy. I am not interested in your trip to Goa. I am interested in your job. Tell me about your job. And often with that type of opening, someone would say, my job, oh, you see this pile of papers? This is my job. And often that's all people will need to start with the issue of telling. Question number two. How, this is not a yes or no question. How healthy are you? Good, bad, what's wrong with it? Someone please role play for me and ask me how healthy I am. Sir, please ask me that question. Just read it from the paper.
How healthy are you?
Healthy.
When you have visited the doctor last time.
Excuse me?
When you have visited the doctor last time.
The last time I visited a doctor. The last time I visited a doctor was actually 6 months ago for rheumatoid arthritis.
So it means you are not so healthy.
You're actually, in that kind of case, you would ask a follow-up question. So, describe to me, was that a one-time visit to the doctor, or was it over several times?
And what's the state of your health, or that you're, problem now, what's the
case
on that?
Exactly. The issue of how healthy are you, it goes back to the question of being uneasy. What is health? And so what we really want to know are frequencies of visits to the doctor. We also want to know how does someone self-perceive their health. There are people who think that going to the doctor maybe 3 or 4 times a year still makes them very healthy, even though they were infirmed and were actually hospitalized. They might consider that to be healthy compared to other people in their family. So again, you're trying to understand what is someone's self-perception of being healthy. Question number four. To understand program effects, what do you think makes the program effective? So I am a principal of a school, I have initiated a program, you come in and you say, what do you think makes the program that you've implemented effective? What's wrong with it?
I'm assuming that the program is effective, it might not.
It is assuming that the program is effective. You are indicating to the interviewee that you want that interviewee to share your underlying assumption that the program is effective. In other words, you are cueing the interviewee how to respond. Everybody in a social situation with an interview is trying to figure out, what does this strange person want from me? What answer do they want? And in this particular instance, the interviewer has put his cards on the table and says, he wants me to talk about the program being effective. I actually think the program is rubbish. I don't think it's effective at all, but how do I know that he won't report to an official? And so we are already indicating there is an assumption embedded in the question itself. Let's think about number seven. I am a researcher who is interested in new ways that teachers use to assess their students' progress in the classroom. And so I am going to interview a group of secondary school teachers. And I am going to ask this question. There are two big problems with this question, probably more. Do you employ formative evaluation measures in your classroom? What's the question, what's the problem that just shoves itself in front of our face?
It's a yes or no question.
It's a yes or no question. It's a yes or no question. And I've just said, whatever you do, if you want to eliminate problems in interviewing, eliminate yes or no questions. So how about, so tell me, what is your position or belief about using formative evaluation measures in your classroom? Let me suggest that it is still a very problematic question.
What is the formative?
What is a formative evaluation measure? That is a concept from my world as a researcher. And what am I saying to the person if they don't really understand that term? What am I saying as I interview? What is the subtext of what I'm saying? You lack something. You're stupid. You're not up on the research. What does that do in the social situation that's created between the interviewer and the interviewee? What happens? All of a sudden, what I've done is taken a yellow magic marker highlighter and I've made in yellow that I am more powerful than you. And imagine it's gender. Imagine that I'm a male and I'm interviewing you. And then all of a sudden, I have the whole element of gender where a powerful male researcher comes in and uses vocabulary that basically says to a woman teacher, you don't know your stuff. Okay? So again, if we want to make people feel comfortable, and this is our biggest problem, one of our biggest problems. Why? Because all of us here are learning concepts from the social sciences. We are learning jargon. We are learning a way to speak that ordinary people don't use. Many of us feel that we, even if it's in English, it's a foreign language with these big words, right? And our professors tell us, the more you use them, the more professional you are, and the fancier you are, and the smarter you are. Well, that's great. But it's also something that separates us from the people that we want to understand. And so we must be very aware about. But notice we're like children with new toys, right? We get these new concepts, postmodernism, and alterity, and other. I mean, we could come up with whole vocabulary lists, and they're like the toys that children play with, and we want to play with our toys. Why are we here if we're not? Don't use them. Yes, you can use them in these places, but when we go across the street and talk to normal people, we have to be aware that when we change what linguists call our register of language, when we use a language that is unfamiliar to them, even though it's the language that they speak, we're using words that are unfamiliar, often the reaction is, rather than getting people to talk, it's actually getting them to shut up. They don't want to talk to us. They feel inadequate. They don't feel confident. And our goal as a social scientist is to understand people rather than to intimidate them. Okay? All right. What I would like to do... Yes, please. Please. But please speak up.
Yeah. This question number one.
Yes?
You told us that there is some problem in this question, that it is not framed in an open-ended manner. But to... whenever we go to take interview, and if we ask a question which is too much open-ended, maybe the interviewee is not able to understand the context in which we are asking that question. He or she may be having n number of things to tell about that question, but it is important on the part of the interviewer that, to some extent at least, he or she should clarify the context in which the interviewer is asking the question. Being too much open-ended sometimes lead to confusion in the mind of the
Wonderful.
Interviewer.
Wonderful. May I ask you your name?
Renu. Yes.
Renu, may I put you on the spot and ask you to come up and demonstrate something with me as a volunteer? Would you mind?
No,
I need to demonstrate. I want to demonstrate exactly what you're talking about, but if you're not comfortable doing it, but you seem confident, but you'd have to make your way and come and interview me here for a second. So please look at this. You want to study how a school implements a new government curriculum for teaching history. You have secured a one-hour interview with the principal to find out about his school's experience. I will like to play the role of the principal. Mm-hmm. I would like you to play the role of the interviewer. Mm-hmm. Think for a second how to begin the interview, and then we will proceed.
I can begin with what all curricular activities your school is involved in, and what kind of educational experiences the children are getting.
Beautiful, beautiful. Okay, so let's lights, camera, action. Hello, very nice to see you. I understand that you've traveled quite a distance to come here. I'm glad that you made it on time. That always is a very good statement about someone. I'm a very busy man, so I'm all yours. I must say, however, that we have an hour time. I'm sorry, I have a parent who is very concerned about her child who is coming in to see me at 5 o'clock, so we have an hour. So, but I'm yours for this time, and I will not even answer if my cell phone, my mobile rings or buzzes. I'm going to ignore it.
So that is the thing, that I have asked a question, it is too much open. No,
excuse me, I'm not understanding. I thought that you were going to ask me some questions.
You're role playing right now.
Okay. So what kind of activities your school is, curricular activities and co-curricular activities your school is involved in?
We are a very innovative school. And this past year, we've undertaken several different initiatives. One is one initiative that I'm very excited about because I've always participated in sports throughout my life, is that we have been engaged in a way of dealing with the physical education of our students. So we're facing many, many problems. Many students are too sedentary now. After their school, they go home and they are doing their schoolwork, and then rather than going out and playing and exercising, they're doing computer games, or they're doing other more sedentary activities. So we are finding increasingly in our school that we must help our students with physical activities. So that's one of the initiatives that comes from the government that I'm very excited about.
Okay. Is there any other kind of initiative that your school has taken?
Perhaps it would be helpful for you that we have three new initiatives, one in physical education, one in the teaching of mathematics, and we have implemented a new history curriculum.
Okay. As far as this mathematics initiative which you talked about, what all things you have done under this initiative to increase the awareness of students regarding mathematics?
This is a very important initiative in mathematics. It is a way of helping students see the beauty of mathematics. You see, when I was a student, when I was a mathematics student, it was oppressive for me. When I was 7 years old, I had a very difficult time memorizing the multiplication tables that my teacher used to walk around with rulers. And if you did not understand, she would actually rap you. I have a scar here for where I was rapped on my hand. And my father was so incensed by this because he saw it not as educational. He saw it as an issue of brutality, that he came in and made an appointment, and to this day, I can remember, he scolded my teacher and was very, very angry. And from then on, I knew that in the teaching of mathematics, we will never, ever scold children. It is part of deeply my own personal identity. And you see, and then when I went to secondary school afterwards, I initially avoided mathematics, but then I had a teacher who tried to create in me the love of mathematics. It was a new curriculum, and instead of memorizing, it focused on a new way of problem solving. And so I would actually bring the notebooks back to my father, and he would sit with me in the evening, and together at my desk, we would...
Okay, after this exercise, I got my answer, that it is the skill of the interviewer. How to means regulate that open-ended answer.
So stay for a second. What could she have done that still understands that there is a power relationship, that this is a principal of a school. He's very busy. He wants to cooperate. What could she have done in this situation? When there is 1 hour and she has truly driven 4 hours to get to a 1 hour interview and there's not a second chance. What is the best thing to do in this social situation? Sir.
So I think that it was very good the way she made you open up with the maths question. I think this could have turned by replying, yes, I face the same problems with history. And so using that word, she could have turned the conversation towards the main topic, the historical topic.
Okay.
Because you're already in a flow.
Other suggestions? Other suggestions that occurred to you as we were undergoing this that she might have done to salvage this time, because 7 minutes of 60 minutes have already elapsed. And without checking him, he seemed like he was going to go on for an hour. And what is the data that she has collected? Nothing. Have we ever met someone who the only thing they want to do is to talk about themselves? Yes, there are many people like that. If they are talking about the topic that is our research question, wonderful. But if they are talking about something off topic, it is a waste of our time.
In such a situation, we have to be very careful that we don't have much of a time to be friendly with that person. We have to begin with the first question we need. Like he said, I have only 1 hour, I'm a very busy person. Then she could have answered that, I'm so happy that you have given me 1 hour from your busy schedule. So now without wasting any time, shall I start from the question I want to ask, sir?
Yes, you may. Please ask it.
I was saying that we can start.
No, you're not. You're going to ask me a question.
So actually, I've heard that the government has introduced a new curriculum for teaching history. And I know your point of view on that. What is it all about?
You see, when I was a child, history was a terrible subject for me because I don't have a good memory. And I used to take pieces of paper and I would write down names and dates. And I found that the only way that I could memorize them was to cut them into small pieces. I would put the paper down like this and I would write the date, and so we could play out the same way. What to do? How recognize, what is the best thing that we can do? The best thing that we can do is to find, sometimes we are interviewing people where we cannot get in a word edgewise. The person is continuing to, often what you find in social research, I'm sure the experienced researchers among us can attest to this. Often when we do policy research and we're interviewing government officials, or I do educational research where I'm interviewing principals and teachers, they are starving to tell their story. No one has asked them how they feel. All of a sudden there is a live human being that is nodding their head and writing things down. It's like someone's listening to me. But you are thinking, oh my goodness, he's only given me an hour and there is nothing on my interview protocol that he is even addressed. And so the best thing that we can do is we can try to, and very much like your question, when you ask something so open-ended, to have specific, more specific probes that are prepared that say, sir, thank you. Your experience as a student is very important. My focus here today, in the very short time that you've been so generous to give to me, is to understand how your particular school has responded to the new government initiative. Can you tell me what your perceptions are of how the teachers have worked with them? And to kind of always bring it back, which means that you have to be clear in your mind about what the interview is about. It is not making that person happy. You might want to do that. That would be a lovely byproduct. But you are often there because somebody else has sent you, somebody else's resources are funding you, and you have a responsibility to discharge. And so if the minutes are ticking and you're not getting anything that you want, you even have to take a risk, which is, and it's always uncomfortable when someone is talking and talking and talking, and you almost have to be, at the risk of being rude, have to say, excuse me, sir. And you try to do it in as friendly and as gentle of a way as possible, but And often people will catch themselves. They'll say, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I got taken away. And they will reorient themselves in order to try to be helpful to someone who's traveled to come and interview them. That's the best thing that we can do. Thank you.
Thank you.
I will, our time has come to a close. If you look at the last page of this handout, it says suggestions for further reading and qualitative methods. It's the last page. I have put down my email address. You may contact me with follow-up questions if you have a follow-up question. Simply identify yourself as where you heard me speak, because I'm speaking throughout the country, so that at least I know that it's here. And the suggestions that I've put here reflect a particular bias. And so in the words of the Latin, caveat emptor, let the buyer beware. My particular bias is I dislike jargon. I dislike the use of terminology that separates us from the people in the world. And so my bias is clear, non-jargon explanations of methodology. So that's my bias. Thank you.
Let me take this opportunity in profusely thanking Professor Samuel Weinberg for coming to our department and delivering these very useful lectures. I think this will provide a food for thought. I've never come across any seminar in this department that 15 minutes past 4 o'clock, still people out here.